to see you walk away from me, child. Ooh. So you see, I love you so much that I don't want to watch you leave me, babe. Most of all, I just don't want to be free, no.
Welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today I have in studio with me Tony Aprile. Tony is the author of Temporary Sojourner and Other South African Stories, which was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. He grew up in South Africa and has received grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Ingram Merrill Foundation. He lives in Bennington, Vermont with his wife, author Judith Schwartz, and son Brendan. His new novel is The Persistence of Memory, published by Norton. Hello there.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show,
it's
Barbara.
It's great to have you here. I've been looking forward to this for months. We've been talking about this for months. The persistence of memory covers the decades when apartheid was in full reign, from the point of view of Paul Sweetbread. And Paul has this memory, this achingly vivid memory. Will you talk about the genesis of the book and of your main character, Paul?
Sure. There are a couple of things about how Paul came to me, I guess, as a character. The first one is I went back to South Africa in 1990 after a long absence, and I had one of the things I discovered on the return visit was how much people had changed their memories, the people who I ran into, old friends or friends of the family, people who lived in my old apartment building, and their memories seemed to have changed to fit the political changes of the time. And I think as someone who had in many ways been outside of the country, been an exile from the country, I'd held on to certain memories of people and really, I think, kept them almost as iconic memories. And the other aspect I noted particularly is how the apartheid government had been very successful in creating a mythology of how what places were, how the people had gotten there, and that there had been this constant erasure of memory in the country. And I decided, at the same time I read a wonderful nonfiction book called Mind of a Nemesis by the Russian psychiatrist A.R. Luria, and it was a case study from the 1920s of a man with a perfect memory. And I thought, well, what if I put these two things together, a country where memory is constantly being erased, and a character who has a steel trap memory and who cannot stop remembering everything, and what happens in terms of his political consciousness, his personal consciousness. And so that's how Paul Sweetbread showed up at my doorstep.
Interesting. So 92 was the last time you went to South Africa.
Yeah, that's correct.
So was the story kind of brewing for a while, or did you come right back and start on it?
Well, the story, I actually wrote the story in Southern California. The first part of it was about 30 pages of what I thought was a novella, and then I just didn't know where to go from there. And plus, South Africa was going through enormous changes, and it seemed to me the changes in the country were moving far faster than my imagination could keep up. So I had this semi-complete novella early around 1991, which I then didn't touch for 11 years. I often thought about it. I wanted to do something with it, but...
you just put it aside?
I put it aside, and I worked on actually two other novels, which I hope to get back to. And then I was at the New York State Summer Writers Institute, and I was asked to give a reading last minute. And I remembered the novella, and I called my wife and asked her to email it to me, which she did. And I read from that. And realized, oh, I really like this character. This character offers a lot of opportunities for me to say things I want to say. I got wonderful feedback from other writers, particularly Howard Norman, who's a writer mm-hmm. I admire a great deal. And I went back and I wrote most of the book in about 8 or 9 months. I then did spend another year completely rewriting the book twice. But... I think it got written very fast because I was brewing these ideas and events for 13 years.
So when you say you went back to rewrite it completely twice, what does that mean?
Actually, what I mean there is to restructure it. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say rewrite completely because I sort of followed my muse. The character being someone who remembers everything, who... loves food, who winds up testing out various forms of memory. And the book is a means both of countering a lot of the history that I was taught in South Africa, which is wrong, also some of the ideas about South Africa that I think can be contested, but also questioning the very nature of what an accurate memory can be. And some of this would just happen by accident. I'd be thinking about a scene, and he winds up listening to an old tape recording of himself reading a poem as a child. And in the background, his father says nothing, but you can hear the father's rocking chair go back and forth. Mm. And the father is now dead when he listens to the tape. And it's a way that memory sometimes is there through absences, through sounds that or things that are peripheral to the immediate story. And I wound up having a number of these set pieces of vignettes in the story, which I wasn't quite sure where they fit, but gradually I realized each one of them is a different aspect of memory. Mm-hmm. And so when I restructured it, I incorporated that into the more linear narrative.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Tony Aprile, author of The Persistence of Memory, published by Norton. Speaking of food, there's so much food in this book. There's so much food. And unlike your very big protagonist, your wife tells me that you weigh what you did when you were 22. So I'm curious about the food aspect in terms of, you know, why did you make your character big? And, you know, so into food. Well, talk about that.
Okay.
That's so interesting.
Well, I love food. I love cooking. I wanted some things about the character that reflect his separateness, his anxiety, his sense of being a freak. And I think some of that just became manifested in having him be a very large and... ultimately, when he goes in the army, someone who's unfit, who's overweight, and but large as well, because that plays in later to when he gets caught up in scenes of violence. I also very much wanted a character who was not myself. So one thing was to make him physically not me.
Mm-hmm.
The food part, I think food is a form of memory. Food is a form of collective memory. We often eat things for comfort we were served in our childhood, which other people may think, this is really a disgusting idea.
Sure.
you're going to eat that, and yet that's the food that you love because you had that when you were 5 years old. So I got to play with that. He absorbs everything. He incorporates everything, both through his mind, but also through his mouth. He's a consumer.
In terms of him not being like you, when I read novels by people I know, I am kind of measuring the novel against mm-hmm. and the character against the author. And as I was reading The Persistence of Memory, I was thinking, this isn't Tony. This is really interesting because, I mean, I know that parts of you have to be in it and certainly your experience of South Africa, but the characters seem so different from what I know about you.
Some things are from our autobiographical in terms of just little bits and pieces of characters, the love of jokes, the love of words, certainly me, the love of digression is me, but it really was something I felt strongly about, that I did not want to write about someone with the kind of good fortune I had had as having a very liberal anti-apartheid background. I'd interviewed a number of Afrikaners who had become anti-apartheid later after growing up in the really in the sort of heart of South African racism and turning against it. And it fascinates me how someone can learn to make a break from the milieu that they've grown up in. And so I wanted, again, someone who winds up having to come to his own sense of self largely through memory, largely through observation, and not through the following of the teaching of his parents or the people around him.
Sure. Interesting. Will you read?
I'd be very happy to. I'm going to read from the opening of the novel. I should just say the book is set into three different parts. It's each one called, one is book one, book two, and book three, corresponding with the different decades in recent South African history. And each decade, I think, was very specific in the kinds of things that went on. I'm reading in the early part is in the late 60s, early 70s. And this is from his school years. It was Miss Tompkins who helped me put a name to the toxin lurking in my being. After the war, Miss Tompkins told our class, her precise English voice nipping off each word like a milliner biting the ends of stray cotton thread, the Red Cross, to whom I was attached, sent packages of food and small household items to the German DPs. Displaced persons, Helen, don't look so ignorant, girl. We discussed this last week. The problem was that the packages were labeled gift, and no one in England bothered to realize that in the German language, gift means poison. That's right, it is similar in Afrikaans. So there were these poor, starving people, European women and children with bloated bellies like malnourished Africans in Ponderland, and rotting away in unopened packages were good British sausages and scones and biscuits. Miss Tompkins, who had a habit of repeating herself as well as of digressing to chide an inattentive child here and there, told us the story at least once every term. Sometimes the gift packages contained sides of beef or smoked hams or squares of Cheshire cheese, Devonshire clotted cream, and Yorkshire pudding, the Red Cross's largesse metamorphosing into longed-for British fare not readily available to Miss Tompkins in benighted South Africa. Her lament seemed directed more at the wasted food than at the sad fate of the deepies, hollow-eyed specters who pursued me unceasingly on those nights I could not sleep. Miss Tompkins spoke to us often of World War II, heralding the start of her reminiscence with one of two phrases, "During the Blitz," or "Before the War." For a time, Nigel Bloomstein and I would amuse ourselves by keeping tally of these talismanic opening gambits, comparing our scores after class. And once Jeremy Goldberg, the class play the fool, piped up, "Was this the Boer War, miss?" earning himself 100 lines to be written after school. Having etched in the assigned sentence, "I would not have survived the Blitz due to the fact that I lack moral fiber," over and over again one long afternoon, he must have come to believe it expressed a fundamental truth about himself, for afterward he lost his characteristic shine of humor and developed into a serious, somewhat melancholy scholar. Miss Tompkins never had a resort to such drastic means to garner my rapt attention, for I knew from early on just how much I owed her for whatever ability I had to make my way through a perplexing and hostile world. It was not, as you might think, simply that she provided me with the revelation that my God or Jean-given natural endowment, a picture-perfect memory, was really itself a poisoned gift, botulin puffing out the sides of baked bean tins, salmonella swarming in the bangers and mash. As early as nursery school, I'd sensed the danger of drawing attention to oneself as an oddity. There can be no more horrifying sight than a crowd of four-year-olds jeering at their fellow cherub who has just soiled his trousers. Lucas Escott, mid-morning break, May 12, 1972. A nervous boy with army-style short back and sides haircut, nystagmic eyes that did not visibly have a point of focus, he became known as Escort Sausages following this incident, the name a reference to a pork-processing town on the main road to Durban, famous for its sausages and penetrating reek of the abattoir. This is precisely the problem with having a power of recall that is not only accurate but empathetic, for at the mere mention of the word Escort, a lumpy stickiness invades the base of my legs, a brown sewer smell rises over the characteristic milk and rodent odor of the little green school. Although the hushed giggles and behind-the-palm whispers of my gentle schoolmates were directed elsewhere at the time, in retrospection they are for my benefit. This is the only distortion my memory allows. I have become their freak. That I have a somatic response to such images can have its uses, though this in spite of years of being plagued by sympathetic responses to thoughts I would have preferred to avoid. You know the mind control game. Don't think of a white bear. Of course, it's hard not to do so. Now try it this way. Don't think of a white bear. Don't think of being torn to shreds by a white bear. Don't feel its savage claws raking deep welts in your thighs and back. Don't feel yourself being devoured piecemeal by a 12-foot white bear. Hand, wrist, radius, ulna. But every cloud has its lining, or as Fanny Dupria, who is determined to uphold his Afrikaner honor in a class full of Jewish boys, like to declare even the blackest Kaffir has white teeth. When the time comes for me to stand in for my army physical, which will not be too long from now, I have the perfect reminiscence in store. That is if I decide not to go ahead and show what sort of stuff I'm really made of. I'm thinking of the day that Mr. Kutsia's Standard 3 class discussed Lord of the Flies, dangerous reading material for such a tender, impressionable age, and more than a few parents blamed Mr. C's poor judgment for what followed next. Had you happened to be driving by my primary school on a certain morning in the year 1976, you would have witnessed Cameron Cramer fleeing in terror from a bloodlusting mob armed with orangewood stakes pulled up from the headmaster's prize rose garden. Roll down your windows, and you can hear the gleeful yelling, "Kill the pig, drink his blood! Kill the pig, drink his blood!" It was only a matter of chance that I ducked a moment or two earlier into a toilet stall to savor a chocolate-covered Turkish delight undisturbed. Cammy was the other fat boy, outclassing me by several layers of adipose tissue. I'd seen him eat, as part of his lunch, not only the edible castanet portion of a small wheel of sweet milk cheese, but its waxy rind as well. I told myself that this was what made him fat, that I could keep my own corporeal self within normal bounds if I did not eat the rinds of cheeses. I was mistaken, of course. Such fine distinctions were quite beyond the rude boys from Standard 3. One fatty was as good as another when it came to the exuberant joy of poking with sticks, the pleasures of righteous violence. It was surely a mitzvah to destroy Beelzebub's representative, no matter how weak and vulnerable he might be, and the hypnotic cadences, "Kill the pig, drink his blood," wiping away any stray thought of mercy.
Thank you so much. That was Tony Aprile reading from The Persistence of Memory. When your book becomes a book on tape, you should do the reading. Tell them
so
that.
I'd like to.
In the beginning of this chapter, the gift packages, true?
Yeah. There was a story an English teacher of ours used to tell. And this really fits my character, that his gift is, it seems to him, often a poisoned one that's more a burden than a gift, as I think many of our endowments are.
Yeah. Also, as you were reading, I was wondering about, sort of in general, how important was it to you to stick to historical fact, to not embellish? You know, I mean, there's so much history in here.
Well,
was that important?
It's really, that's a hard question to answer because the book is really about questioning historical fact. Because
right.
I think there are very few facts in South Africa that are not disputed. Mm. And in some ways, I see this as a reflection in the U.S. as well, that there are different truths depending on who's telling them. And this is one of the things that my character encounters over and over again. And that the view he might have of the world is going to be very different from the view someone else might have. The only embellishment I think that's really here is occasionally for humor, for the absurdity of the situation. But one doesn't need to embellish much in South Africa. There was plenty of absurdity to go around without having to add anything. Hmm. So I was pretty careful on fact-checking in terms of I do believe there is, actual verity of experience, but how that experience gets remembered and changed is part of what makes makes our cultures, makes us who we are.
Sure, you were a boy when you left South Africa.
Yeah, well, I also went back as a teenager and worked. So that was actually a very important time.
Interesting. And talk about that.
I went back between countries, between continents, because my family moved to the U.S. Supposedly only for 1 year, but we wound up deciding to stay on here. My father actually lost the job he had in England, got a job here, and so I wound up trying to go to college at about the age of 15, and I took some time off between. The job I had was for the Johannesburg municipality, and they ran double-decker buses, and they were trying to decide whether there were parts of the city that they should only have a single-decker bus in. So they hired a number of people like myself to be on the streets from about 5 o'clock in the morning till about 6 o'clock in the evening, stopping buses and counting how many people on the bottom of the bus and how many were on the top. And it was one of those wonderfully absurd jobs where I had to be in one place in different parts of the city every day with a lot of time on my hands to simply watch the life around me. And I think a perfect kind of thing for a writer is
sure.
The sort of enforced idleness. So,
were you a writer then, at least in consciousness?
In consciousness, I was moving in that direction. I was until my teenage years, I was very interested in animals and wanted to be a naturalist.
Hmm.
And then I think that actually was a good thing as a writer, learning to sit quietly and observe animals in this case. And then I realized as a teenager that people were very interesting, especially women. And so I think I started reading also much more fiction and less about the nature of animals. And also I think out of a certain nostalgia, I read a lot of South African fiction in my teenage years, quite a bit of it beyond the my sort of level of reading, but just wanting a taste of the country that we'd left behind that I still loved and missed.
Hmm.
And so probably, yeah, by the time I was 16, I was pretty sure I was going to be a writer. It took quite a long time before that was realized.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Tony Aprile, author of The Persistence of Memory. We're going to take a real short break, and when we come back, we will be with Tony to the end of the hour, so please stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with Tony Eprile. And before we go on, I should say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. Hello again.
Hi. There.
Here we are. I wanted to know, I've been thinking about this too, because you left South Africa so long ago and have been back, but still you've left and have been here for so long. How was it to have to live in that world again in terms of writing this book? I mean, it seems like your main character has such an incredible memory, and you must have such an incredible memory as well, and to have to go into so many parts of your past. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because I think for writers, for novelists, one of the pleasures of writing is that you do get to inhabit a different world. And for me, some of this had to do with having to go into a space where no one else was around, so I could simply live in that world for a few hours, really think about it, really occupy it. I've also taught South African literature and culture, South African film. I've been very much in contact with the history and the events in the country, and with friends and a variety of people. So it's something that wasn't a large shift for me to step back and think about it, but also sometimes to think about it in terms of South Africa offering a certain extreme exaggeration of things that exist in the U.S. And I would include the way that historical memory has been changed or transformed or ignored. Hmm. And actually, the middle part of the book, I started writing because one of the formative experiences, one of the major experiences for men of my generation was the war in Namibia, and I found myself thinking a great deal of what would I have done had I stayed in the country. Would I have become a draft resister? Would I have become involved in that? Or would I have gone into the army, and how would that have been? So in a way, it was a way of thinking about that somehow there's a Tony Eprile who continued to live in South Africa and didn't move with his family and leave, and what was his life going to be like.
Hmm. Interesting.
The book is both, I think, an act of memory, but very much an act of imagination. And I think memory and imagination are much more closely linked than we sometimes like to think. That when we have a very vivid memory, each time we have that memory, we are recreating it. And I think one can improve one's memory, make it more accurate, just by constantly remembering certain things, thinking about them. But each one is an act of creativity, of rebuilding, starting from small details. And I read a number of books on the physiology of memory, and this is the sort of most current, most likely theory of memory, is that we have a very small piece that we build each memory from.
That's interesting. I wonder that at times, if I actually said such and such or did such and such, or do I just remember it that way?
Right. I find myself remembering things that were stories my parents have told me. I'd heard them often enough and imagined them often enough that I would find myself thinking I'd really been there. But then I would look back and realize actually I was maybe a year old, a year and a half old when that happened. So it's unlikely I would have had those particular observations. I do think people who leave their country of childhood tend to become very interested in memory and or to blot it out completely. That's the other extreme, is to try and forget completely that those early years. But so many of the writers I've admired and enjoyed have been writers who've had some form of exile, and who perhaps because you wind up building up that place that you left in your mind, in your imagination and memory, it's a natural step to then move on to want to recreate it on paper.
So true. What about research in terms of this book? How much did you have to research?
I don't think of it as having to research, except that I did a tremendous amount of interviewing, reading. Partly that was something I was doing over the years anyway, because as I realized what an effect the war in Namibia and Angola had had, any time I met a white South African of my age, I would ask that question. I'd say, were you in Namibia? Where were you? What did you do? And many of these people had not been asked before. It was something, it's very much a repressed memory. And I started, with each questioning, to realize how important and how significant that was in the lives of South Africans. So that the research was a natural part of my other interests, my interest in the literature of the country, my interest in the changing events. Still I did a great deal of fact checking for the novel. And I probably will still be doing that.
Do you enjoy that part of it? The research, fact-checking?
Yes, I do. I think it can become a crutch. And that's one thing to be aware of. In the other novel I was working on, which I think I'll be going back to, was on war artists in the Second World War. And I've read far more than I can ever use. And I think after a while you can think, well, I just need to find out one more thing, and then you avoid doing the writing that way.
So how do you make yourself stop? You just stop, say, all right, put the books away.
Sometimes, well, with this particular book, it was having a character who demanded my attention. I found I'd much rather spend time with my character than with the historical books or with some of the journals or what other people had written. And I think that's often the issue, is that you need to, the facts only matter, the history only matters in relation to how it changes and affects the character who you've created, if that's an interesting and important character, for you, the writer at any rate.
Interesting. Well, let's shift gears just a little bit, because you teach writing.
Right. I've been teaching in a number of places. I've been a visiting writer at schools like Williams and Wesleyan. Right now I'm teaching in a low residency MFA program at Lesley University. And students come for a 9-day residency, and then every month they send me work and I respond to that. And that's been quite an interesting experience. I have it's got a wonderfully diverse faculty, quite an international faculty, and so that's been interesting too. I also am the novel consultant or novel doctor at the New York State Summer Writers Institute, and I read 350-page novels and meet with the students about those. And I'm reading there really for structure, and so that's been an education for me in terms of thinking really about plot and structure and what works structurally and what doesn't.
So do you find that that a person is either a writer or they're not? I mean, can you see early on that someone has it or they don't? Or is it a matter of learning craft and learning, you know, the skills and gaining the chops of a writer?
I think it works differently for different people. I've known a few people who I one knew years ago that they would be writers, and they are. On the other hand, when I think back to my graduate school MFA program, the people who are still writing are the people who are still writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as simple as that. You really couldn't tell. Some of the most talented people disappeared completely. Others really grew enormously and continued to write. And so it's one of those things that varies. Some people have a natural talent. It's part of the way they think. It's part of the way their minds work. Others come to it through a lot of hard work. And again, developing those skills, developing those that ability to observe, and reading a lot. I think loving to read is a vital part of it.
Mm.
So I don't have an easy answer to
that
question.
Sorry. There's a few easy answers, aren't there?
Right.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Tony Prile, author of The Persistence of Memory, published by Norton. I recall you saying a while ago that one thing you do when you teach, or one sort of exercise that you have students do, is you have them start with research as a means to getting involved with a project.
And, yeah, I think I started that partly out of the usual creative writing teacher's boredom with reading the same kinds of story over and over again, which when you have college students of a certain age, there are certain experiences that everyone has had, and those often show up in the stories. And it's a desire to see people really step out of themselves and apply the kind of empathy that I think a writer can apply, and that's an important part of why one becomes a writer. So I have my students go to the American Memory website, which is at the Library of Congress, and it's part of the WPA Oral History Project that's now online. It's very easy to get, and these are wonderful interviews, many of them by writers, so they are shaped by quite creative people in terms of how they interviewed, but they're interviews with ordinary people all over the U.S. Farmers in Florida, hardware store owner in Kansas, and learning how someone got there, what their lives are like. And what I ask is to go and read them, find one that really strikes one's imagination, and write a story from that. And I had quite wonderful stories that came out of this.
So how does teaching affect your own writing?
It's difficult because I think teaching occupies much of the same kind of energy and attention that writing does. So on the one hand, teaching is very bad for my writing, and I think it's a difficult thing for writers in general that teaching can have this effect of the rewards are much faster than you get when you go and try and sit down and write a novel. You can see vast improvements in other people's work, which you don't necessarily see when you sit down and write yourself. On the other hand, it's a joy to have a job that involves reading, that involves talking to people, one's students and colleagues, about the imagination, about their ideas, about their experiences. So there's a great deal of pleasure in it as well. I think the novel consulting has been useful in really making me think about the importance of structure, of a larger structure. Because so often someone will have an excellent section in a book, and then the rest it's lopsided in terms of the rest of the work.
Touring, book signing, how is that for you?
I haven't done that much of it. I gave it a number of readings on the East Coast. I live in Vermont now, and partly they coincided with the teaching I do in the summer. I also went to Boston to give a reading, and I think I'm very divided on these things. I enjoy the engagement with the audience. I enjoy reading from the book. I'm not sure sometimes if it makes sense to travel for 2 days to read to six strangers. Mm-hmm. it's very nice. I enjoy those six strangers, but are those 2 days of time worth it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and what about reviews? Because you're also a reviewer. Yes?
Right. Yes,
and,
I do.
And, you know, so I think reading reviews of your own work when you are a reviewer can be an interesting experience. Do you pay attention to them? Do you read them?
I do read them. I know people, some people who say they don't read any reviews of their books, which I find hard to believe. I've actually been very happy with the reviews that in that most of them have been very positive. Mm-hmm. I find to some extent the reviews tend to reflect the who the person is who's reviewing, which makes sense. There's nothing we write that doesn't reflect ourselves.
Sure.
And I guess if there's anything I'm disappointed in is that the humor in the book has not been highlighted much in the reviews. But I can't complain too much because I've had some wonderful reviews here.
That's an interesting thing because there's so much black humor and it's written with a certain, I don't know, I guess satire. It's written very satirically. And I'm curious why... Why did you do that? Why did you choose to write about South Africa in that way?
I think because the system there was ridiculous. And the books that have most gripped me that have been written about it, they're wonderful satires by black South African writers. I've long admired the work of a satirist who does a one-man, or actually one-woman show, Peter Dirk Uys, and he referred to, in the apartheid years, he said he got his best material from the Government Gazette. And I think it's a wonderful tool against the sort of oppressive elements in government and bureaucracy is to just not take them seriously or to push what they do and say just that little step further into satire. And often it's really not much of a step at all.
Mm.
And so it certainly that appealed to me. It's also a chance to undercut things that may, if just taken too seriously, become burdensome and too clear cut. And I want the book to have a lot to do with questioning the reality around us.
Sure. What has been the reaction from South Africa?
I've had a number of South African friends who've read it who liked it. I'm having trouble selling the book in South Africa.
Mm.
I'm not sure if that's because the voice and the in some ways the writing is geared a little more to the American audience. Although I wanted to mean a little more to South Africans reading it, but I try and explain and. Point out what might be obvious to South African, but within the context of the novel. South Africans tend to be very suspicious and annoyed with anyone who writes about the country who doesn't live there.
But you're from there.
Right, but it doesn't matter. There's even when I'm there and traveling there are people who might dislike Gordimer's work or love Gordimer's work and dislike Coetzee's work. South Africans tend to form pretty strong opinions. My worst review was from a South African reviewer who probably had the most similar background to me of any of the reviewers. And it's a very personal, angry review. It didn't, to me, seem to have much to do with the book.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that reviewers are able to be objective, or do they... At least with this novel, are they coming more from their own personal sort of experience or agenda?
I think, again, that's it depends on who's reviewing it. I think I've had a number of wonderful reviewers of the book who certainly were being objective, but again, there's no way to be completely objective.
Mm-hmm.
What I might do here is just talk a little about when I review books, I really try and make an effort to do what I do with my novel manuscript consults, is to think about the book that the author was trying to write.
Sure.
And how successful that is, and not try to think about the book I would have written mm-hmm. had I been the person writing it. And I think the worst kind of reviewing is the reviewing where the reviewer is showing how much cleverer he or she is than the author of that particular mm-hmm. book. And had sort of be what's implied is, right. had I written this book, it would have been wonderful, but the way this idiot wrote it, it's terrible. And I've been fortunate here with reviewers who've made a big leap in terms of really going after the book and understanding some of the more difficult aspects. And it's wonderful when you learn from reviews, and that I certainly have.
That happens?
Yes.
That's a good thing. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Tony Prile, author of The Persistence of Memory, published by Norton. A few more things, actually so many things, and I know we're not going to get to all of it before our time's up, but will you talk about the language in this book, too? You have so many original similes and metaphors that I started taking note, and then I just thought, you know, I'm just not going to mark these down anymore. But, you know, and it's really hard to come up with original similes and metaphors as a writer. I think that's one of the hardest things. But just in general, the book is so crafted, and does that come piece by piece? Do you wait till you have what you consider an entire draft that you're happy with and then go over it? How are you working with language? Or is it as you go and you're crafting it as you go?
I think it's very much I'm crafting it as I go. I find myself... It's very difficult for me to read books that are filled with cliches, even when the characters are quite interesting and mm-hmm. the unless the language itself is really gripping me and interesting me, I find I often wind up just putting books aside. And so I have this sense of anathema towards cliche, though of course there are cliches in the book, and my editor caught quite a few, and I'm sure there are some that both he and I missed, and one just sort of looks back in horror and said, that's how I wrote that.
I can't remember any, but
well, good.
I believe
Thank you. I'm long been fascinated by metaphor, and one of the wonderful things about the character that I worked with here, the narrator and protagonist, is that I got to be quite playful in the largeness of the language, because he's a larger-than-life figure for me. He's someone who... remembers everything calls forth another association, and so I got to have a very good time playing with language mm-hmm. association and with images and ideas, and also the way that different languages in a country butt against each other. Mm-hmm. And South Africa today has 11 official languages mm-hmm. and but the in growing up there's almost a in an English-speaking environment, there's almost a strong desire on the part of English speakers to avoid learning any other languages, mm-hmm. as if this was something to be proud of, that not speaking Afrikaans was an important skill, and not speaking Zulu also was an important skill to have.
Interesting.
And I just find that, again, quite funny and mm-hmm. bizarre.
What a complex country.
So, yeah. Well,
on so many levels.
Right. It certainly is. It's funny, though, again, being back in Southern California, where I've lived on and off, I remember coming across a book here that the bookstore owner told me was quite a very good seller, which is called Homemade Spanish, M-A-I-D, Spanish. And it's just enough Spanish for telling your maid how to separate the darks from the light-colored clothes and how to wash the lettuce.
Yeah. Yeah, how to talk to your gardener.
Right.
We have a few minutes left, and I'm not sure what I want to talk about, because I want to ask you about Paul Sweetbread's name. I want to ask mm-hmm. you about Liddy and Roloff. I want to ask you about writing about war as our country was going to right. war.
It was an eerie experience, because I had actually been writing about war earlier with the earlier novel, The War Artist, and one of the journalistic pieces I'd done was to interview draft resistors from South Africa who had These were white men who refused to serve in the army, and the one of them in particular had been the first person to get a 6-year jail sentence, which was the equivalent amount of time that people served in the army. And I thought these were a very interesting group and quite heroic, but they had a tremendous effect, because by the year 1989, a quarter of all draftees did not show up for the draft call. And that's quite extraordinary in a country where people were being actively prosecuted and put in jail. The more I read about the war and the more I talked to veterans of the Angola and Namibia conflict, the more I realized that this was another of these kinds of follies that politicians had gotten their young men into. And there'd been quite awful atrocities in that war, but as one reads about other wars, it wasn't that surprising, particularly when you have an unseen enemy that's part of the local population. The response on the part of soldiers is going to be a lot of anger and violence, unless they're well disciplined to not engage in that. And even when they are, it's still very hard to separate. So while I'm writing this, and the government here was talking about how quickly the Iraq conflict was going to be over, chills ran up my spine, because that's exactly the rhetoric that was used to get the South Africans into the Angola conflict. And 15 years later, they finally managed to pull out of that.
Oh, my goodness.
But it's also part of the awareness I had that most men in history had some experience of war, whether or not they wanted to, usually didn't want to, and that my own generation in the U.S. had been quite fortunate in having managed to avoid war for all this time. And so seeing another generation, particularly the volunteers who are going into it, I have a strong pacifist streak, but I also think that most people don't want to think about the reality of the tasks that our soldiers have to do, and what kinds of trauma we're subjecting them to. I think people would be slower to engage in a conflict, more inclined to really try and see if there are any other ways around it before doing that.
Yeah. We have a minute left, and I wanted to ask you before we go if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
I guess my main advice for all writers is to enjoy it. I certainly found that when I was writing well, it was the pleasure was in the writing. To read a lot and enjoy reading, I think that most writers who I know, professional writers, one of the things we love to do is talk about books we've read that have excited us. And so I'm always surprised when students say, well, I really don't have time to read much. It just doesn't seem to work. It's like, well, you know, go to sleep half an hour later and read something. I think most writers are reading addicts. And I can't sleep unless I read for 15 minutes or so, or longer. So I would say, yes, read and challenge yourself in your reading. Read different things. Read work that's very unlike your own work. So those would be major pieces of advice. I think enjoy the play of words, the puns in the different language that one can explore. I had a graduate school roommate who got quite annoyed that a number of other people around him, he thought had a better vocabulary than he did, so he started reading the dictionary. And he had been a semi-professional soccer player before he went to graduate school, and he used to walk up and down and read the dictionary, kick the soccer ball, mark the word, and in different color inks. I'm not sure I'd suggest being that obsessive, but if you come across an unfamiliar word, look it up. Don't limit yourself. Don't flatten out your language.
Yeah. You have a few words that sent me to the dictionary. And I like that.
Thank
you so much for being here.
Thank you, Barbara, for having me on the show.
And just continued good luck with The Persistence of Memory.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful book. Again, I've been with Tony Aprile, author of The Persistence of Memory, published by Norton. And I always talk about covers, and I didn't say anything about this one, but it's quite striking. And you really need to take a look at this book. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website at writersonwriting.com, and there you can email me to be on the weekly email list. I will leave you with a quote by John Steinbeck, who said, "We work in our own darkness a great deal with little real knowledge of what we are doing." And thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week. Fana indana to namhlanje.